Thank you so much. Good morning, Dawson.
Good morning.
All right, we're all awake? Everyone's awake? Good, good, good. That good meal you just had. So I'd like to thank Ms. Debbie, as well as the Health Ministry, for this invitation. Today we're going to talk a little bit about... There you go. Can you hear me now? Okay. We're going to talk a little bit about brain health. In particular, some of the concerns that we may have as we age about our memory. Okay, we're going to start off talking about a few things about dementia, which is a concern for a lot of our elderly population, as well as how we come to that determination. And then we're going to, you know, finish up with the good news, learn more about memory, what it entails, as well as lifestyle modifications that we can make to improve our memory overall. So here's a few facts about dementia, why this topic is so important and so popular, because it's a sixth or high leading cause of death, sixth in the U.S., a sixth leading cause, and about 5 million are currently living with the disease. That breaks down to about every 67 seconds someone in the United States develops dementia. So this is a very prominent epidemic in our society, and it costs quite a bit to take care of this population, anywhere from facilities to wages lost by the caregivers and taking care of costs from secondary injuries from dementia as well. So it's a very, very important topic to discuss. So some people want to know, what is dementia? It's very critical to know that all memory loss is not dementia. What makes us think about dementia is when the symptoms are progressive and non-reversible. That's a very critical part of how we define dementia, because there are a lot of things that can affect your memory that are reversible, and we'll talk about some of those things today. So a progressive, non-reversible decline in cognitive function that significantly impacts the daily activities. That's another critical part. So some things we forget, we may forget someone's name or forget that word we wanted to say, but how does it impact your daily life? Because there is some occasional forgetfulness that is a part of normal aging. The other part of the memory deficit that we pay attention to as clinicians is, how is it interrupting their social interaction? So are they still able to function with their family members as normally, as well as in their occupation if they're still working? So some of the things I look to hear from a patient when they come into my office are memory loss, like I said, that interrupts their daily function. They used to be able to operate the family business without problems, and all of a sudden they can't do calculations, things like that. Challenges in problem solving and inability to complete tasks. That's another big sign that makes us think, is there a non-reversible progressive condition going on? It's often common that as we age, we can't remember the exact date, but in patients with dementia, they may forget what city they're in, and they've lived in that city for years and years and years. So occasional time or being off a day or two, that's a part of normal aging. But when they can't remember places they've been for a long time, or even the year in particular, that really signifies something greater is going on. Because of the part of the brain that dementia affects, sometimes there's issues with visual and spatial relationship. So understanding themselves as it relates to their environment is another big sign that we see in patients with dementia. I had a patient who would walk past the mirror and think that someone else was there, not really associating it with herself. Also, new problems with words and speaking and writing. Usually, if you can't think of the word, you usually can get a cue and someone can kind of cue you into it. However, there are occasional times where we see a problem both in their speaking and their writing, and that makes us think that something more severe is going on as well. We all misplace things, but a lot of times if we really sit down and think about it, we can retrace our steps and find that thing again. However, in patients with dementia, they're not able to retrace their steps and go back to find that object. Poor judgment is another huge sign. I had another patient that decided to go visit her daughter in Florida at 2 o'clock in the morning, things like that. These are examples of signs that are associated with memory loss that we think about dementia. And then changes in mood and personality, and most commonly, because of all these changes, patients tend to withdraw from their environment. So I thought this slide was really, really important because one of the most common consultations I get is as in our elderly population is, am I having signs of dementia or is this just normal aging? And I felt like this slide really kind of highlighted some of the differences. So as it pertains to memory loss, in normal aging, as I said, occasional forgetfulness is normal, okay? Especially if it's not interrupting your daily function or social interaction. However, people with dementia have a problem acquiring new knowledge. So you can tell them something new and almost immediately they're unable to store that information. And we'll talk about components of memory and why that happens. Okay, in normal aging, you sometimes can have trouble finding the right word or forgetting a name of someone. However, again, because of the inability to lay down new memory, our dementia patients forget words and substitute unusual words for the word they're looking for. It also makes both speech and writing very difficult, and that's, again, another sign that cues us into something much more progressive. In terms of normal aging, it may take you longer to complete tasks or longer to learn a new thing. However, people with dementia have trouble with even everyday tasks that they've been doing for years. So these are all ways to kind of differentiate between normal aging and dementia. Again, so you can forget the exact date or the day of the week and not fear necessarily that you're having dementia, taking more time, slowed reaction time, and occasional forgetfulness. So here are some of the stages of dementia. Stage one is normal. This is when, if we were to take a slice of a patient's brain that was in this preclinical stage, you would see the pathological changes associated with dementia, but no clinical signs. When you get into stage two, the person starts to notice their own deficit, but family, friends, and the physician hasn't seen it yet. By stage three, we're starting to pick up things on our mini mental status exam, which we'll talk a little bit about later, and some of you may or may not have had that before. And stage four is where we really see most of our patients when they start having trouble with calculation, start forgetting personal history, like where they've lived for years. Social withdrawal also begins at that time. Stage five is our moderate severe category, where they begin to need help with everyday activities. At this stage, they still remain independent with eating and using the facilities. However, everyday tasks that they used to do very easily begin to show deficits at that time. Stage six is when they require help with those activities of daily living, taking their medications, dressing and bathing and things like that. And this is where we have trouble with wandering and patients getting lost. It's also significant personality changes at this stage. And stage seven is end stage, where they're basically bedbound and very little speech production or movement occurs. So we've all heard about different types of dementia. Probably the most common types are Alzheimer's and vascular dementia. We now believe that most cases are kind of a mixed bag. So a lot of people ask, well, what is senile dementia? Well, senile dementia is a grab bag term for all of these, okay? So the senile part referring to the population that's usually affected, but the different names really is not as important to the treatment as it is more for the medical staff to know what's happening under the microscope, okay? So dementia clinically looks the same for the most part, but pathologically there are two different things going on with Alzheimer's and vascular dementia. And again, if we were to take a specimen of the patient's brain, we would see both changes that are associated with those conditions. So what's going on with a patient that has dementia is really important to know what the lobes of your brain do, to understand what parts of the brains are being affected and why those deficits occur. Okay, So the frontal lobe is responsible for our planning. It's what helps us to be able to execute tasks in an orderly fashion. It's also where a lot of our personality is held, as well as our organization and our emotions as well. Another very critical part is the temporal lobe. So this is heavily associated with memory and our language center, both our understanding of language and our expression of language. The parietal lobe is the part that helps us understand ourselves in relationship to our environment. It's also a part that's really important in math as well as reading as well. And then our occipital lobe is important in terms of vision. It's not usually as affected or even affected that much during these with these dementias, but the frontal lobe, the temporal lobe, and the parietal lobe are all parts of the brain that can be affected with different types of dementia. So as I stated, the Alzheimer's is the most common type. Age of onset is typically greater than 60. There are some cases of early onset that have a heavy genetic predisposition. We associate that with chromosome 27. But in most cases, it is a sporadic case, and that would be in our older population, those older than 60. We believe what happens is that there's an accumulation of abnormal proteins that build up in the cells of the brain and cause them to die prematurely, and in specific parts of the brain, the temporal lobe and the parietal lobe. And remember, those are heavily important in terms of memory as well as visual spatial relationships. Then there's the vascular dementia. So this is what we call our mini stroke or multi-infarct dementia. We've probably heard many people refer to it as the stroke dementia. And it basically progresses in a more stepwise fashion, whereas Alzheimer's is slowly progressive. Vascular dementia kind of hits in stages, and you'll have one clear neurologic deficit. It'll be quiet for a while, and then again, another steep decline. And like I said before, a lot of times patients will experience a mixture of these types of dementia. Because of the different parts of the brain that can be affected by stroke, the clinical presentation can actually vary quite a bit, depending on where the mini stroke has occurred. The biggest risk factors for this condition are diabetes, hypertension, and high cholesterol. Okay, so how do we evaluate patients with dementia when they come in or come in with a complaint of memory loss? Okay, so a lot of times children will bring in their parents, or the patient may bring themselves in and say, I'm thinking I'm having memory loss. So I listen first for those key things that I talked about, problems with their calculation or problem solving, or just being able to complete tasks. I'm listening to hear what are the things that they feel are causing them memory loss. And then I examine them to see their neurologic exam to see if there's any focal weakness or numbness or balance problem. A really important part of the exam is called the mini mental status exam, and some of you may have had it before where they ask you, where you are, the date, what floor are you on. They may ask you to name objects or draw a clock, and that's basically a screening test that lets us know if there is a greater problem than normal aging, okay? The perfect score is a 30 out of 30. Anything less than 27, we go digging a little bit deeper, okay? And then as a part of the workup, we're always looking for reversible causes of memory loss. A really huge one that we're seeing a lot in the community is vitamin B12 deficiency. So almost all of our elderly patients get a B12 check on a regular basis, because if it's very, very low, or even less than 400, which is low normal, you can start to have problems in your neurologic system, including memory loss. We check thyroid function, because if it's too high or it's too low, it can also affect your brain function. Especially in our patients that have a history of heavy alcohol abuse, we check for liver enzymes to make sure they're not elevated. And because the liver, when it's not working properly, you can accumulate a certain toxin called ammonia that really likes to hang out around the brain and cause confusion and memory problems, so we check that as well. We also check for other infections, and in our diabetics in particular, we look for glucose, because chronically low glucose can also affect your cognition. There are some cases with the mini mental status exam that are borderline, where it's not quite sure if it is a normal aging process or just we caught the patient on a bad day. So sometimes we need to do neuropsychological testing, which our psychology department helps us out with, by testing different parts of the brain specifically with certain tasks and screening tests. And sometimes that's helpful, because one of the huge mimics for dementia is actually depression. or what we call pseudo-dementia. And because the part of the brain that is associated with mood is also the same as the part of the brain that's associated with memory, it's very difficult for you to lay down new memory if you're extremely anxious or extremely depressed. So that's why it's really important that sometimes if we're not quite sure if there is a psychological overlay, we sometimes bring in our neuropsychological testing as well. It's always that we will try to look at the brain at least in the beginning of the evaluation because we want to know, one, is there a focal area that is more atrophied than the other? Here's an example. So for Alzheimer's in particular, so this is our normal control, and if you notice very obviously there's a huge change between this space and this space. So this is the parietal lobe and this is the temporal lobe, and these are the fluid-filled spaces of the brain we call ventricles. And as you can see, because the cells around those ventricles have died out, this patient had very advanced stage dementia, and so this is an example of a brain that we may see in an Alzheimer's patient. Here we have a vascular dementia patient, and if you can notice that this area is a little bit wider than the surrounding areas, and this is a result of little tiny blood vessels being plugged up over time. This patient had hypertension, diabetes, and high cholesterol, and over time this confluent area just becomes all white, and we call that white matter disease, and this is a result of years of uncontrolled hypertension and diabetes. So as you know, there is no cure for dementia. The medications that are offered are basically thought to slow the progression of the disease. One chemical that the brain uses for memory is called acetylcholine, and these medications allow more of that chemical to be available to the brain to lay down new memory. So a lot of times these drugs help to stabilize our patients, or they can see slight improvement in the beginning, but because the overall process is progressive, those proteins are building up because of abnormal metabolic process. That process continues to happen, so this medication is only symptomatic and it does not stop the progression of the accumulation of those proteins. So what is going on with memory? Like, a lot of times people will say, I have a bad memory, as if it's a part of their brain that you could point to and say, this is where my memory is located. The truth is that memory is a process. It involves more parts of the brain than just the temporal lobe. You can have some interaction with the frontal lobe as well as parietal lobe that help trigger a memory. The process of recall includes three basic steps, the first of which is encoding. And encoding has to do with what you perceive from your environment, what you see, what you touch, what you hear. And so memories start with what you perceive from your environment. After you encode or you perceive what's going on, it goes very quickly into your short-term memory, okay? And then if your brain deems it important, it will store it or attach it to something that is attached to your long-term memory, okay? And once it's in that long-term memory, it is much easier to retrieve. So if you're saying you have a bad memory, usually it's not all these parts of the condition. It's not usually all these parts of the condition. It's usually either a problem with encoding or storage or retrieval. A really critical point here is that attention and concentration is very key. So a lot of times I find that the issue is encoding because of poor concentration or attention. And what are some of the things that can affect that? Include hearing loss, so you're not perceiving it to even remember it, or you hear parts of it. Or mood problems, poor sleep, because if you're not sleeping well, you're not going to be as attentive as someone who has great sleep. So that's really important before you blame it on the memory. There may be something that's stopping you from encoding the information to begin with, okay? So why we're all here is to see if there's anything we can do to slow this progression or prevent it altogether. The classic duo that we talk about with most neurodegenerative conditions is that it's a balance between nature and nurture. Some of us just have bad genes. I mean, it's nothing we could do about that. That's what we were given. However, the nurture component is what we can do to either slow the progression or prevent further damage to our brains at all. So the two most notable genetic causes of dementia are chromosome 22, and chromosome 17. These patients, when we say early onset, we're not talking in the 60s, we're talking about 30s and 40s. These patients have very, very early dementia. So at that point, there's really nothing, no treatment that can really prevent that. However, in a lot of the sporadic cases, we're finding new evidence that our lifestyle modifications are very critical in terms of preventing that condition. So the main main areas we're going to talk about today are diet, exercise, sleep, managing our other medical problems, and mental stimulation. So we've all heard of like the omega-3 fatty acids and their impact on memory. Here are a few foods that are rich in these type of compounds. The idea behind the vitamin E, the vitamin C, and omega fatty acids is that in all of our cells of our body, they're constantly doing things to produce energy sources. And as a part of these processes that produce energy, there are byproducts or waste products. The antioxidants are vitamin E, vitamin C, and there is some antioxidant effect in the omega fatty acids. These are to break down the accumulation of these toxins that cause the cell to die out spontaneously. Some of these include nuts, sunflower seeds, peanut butter, fish, not all fish. The biggest ones are mackerel, tuna, salmon. I think those are the main three that I know of. Avocado also is pretty heavy in omega fatty acids, whole grains, and green leafy vegetables. There are some evidence that one or two cups of coffee does improve memory. I have to, you know, give that caveat because now all our coffee drinkers are really excited. But the truth is, if you drink too much coffee, of course, it makes you more jittery, you have more issues with headaches. But because of the stimulation to attention, and remember, attention is really important to encoding the information to begin with, one or two two cups of coffee are pretty much recommended at times, okay? The other thing that most people don't expect to really help memory is red wine and dark chocolate. So again, one or two cups or glasses of red wine does stimulate memory in some studies, as well as dark chocolate. And there's a specific compound in these compound is called I think it's levestrol, and it basically helps to stimulate encoding into the brain and storage for later retrieval. So as far as exercise, what's good for the heart is good for the brain. And so what we recognize is that we use the American Heart Association's recommendations for 30 minutes of moderate intensity exercise 5 times a week. Okay, now I know that sounds like a lot. And in our elderly population, we don't recommend that you start out that way unless that's how you've been all of your life. A lot of times we'll recommend starting one time a week for 30 minutes or less to begin with. But the goal or recommendation from American Heart Association is to try to get up to 30 minutes 5 times a week. If there's a predisposition for heart disease or a history of heart disease, you want to get a doctor's approval before you start any type of regimen to avoid precipitating any cardiac event. And also, we encourage you to start with low intensity and gradually accelerate. A lot of times, our physical therapists help us out in terms of determining how much you can take over time and how to progress from your initial low intensity, but some patients just can kind of gauge on their own. We also encourage companion or group exercise, not only for the motivation, but in case of a medical emergency during the exercise. As we spoke about, sleep is really important to improving attention. So some of the benefits of good sleep is that it makes you feel better in terms of your mood. So if you're not sleeping well, you don't feel so good. You can also decrease stress, and it helps to move those encoded perceptions into storage. So during your sleep, your brain is still moving. It's still working to create memories. So good sleep helps you to hold on to your memories a lot better. A lot of times we are screening patients for obstructive sleep apnea because it has an increased risk of heart attack or stroke, which, as we said, those two can lead to vascular dementia. So if you're snoring, you're feeling excessively tired during the day, or even sometimes our loved ones will come in and say, yeah, I've actually witnessed the apneas. These are all important things to address as it pertains to memory. When we talk about good sleep habits, we basically say that the bed is just for sleeping. And so if you can avoid eating in the bed, doing work in the bed, other things, just basically training your body to use the bed for its sole or main purpose. As we talked about earlier, hypertension, diabetes, and high cholesterol are all huge, huge, huge diseases that impact vascular dementia. We can't stress enough the importance of compliance with medication, as well as constant monitoring. I find that a lot of times, sometimes patients will wait in between each appointment before they make modifications to their drugs or to their medication. So if you're monitoring your blood sugars on a regular basis, your blood pressure, sometimes you can call into the office and those adjustments can be made, because sometimes appointments are 3 or 6 months out. And so all the while your brain is functioning in these higher blood sugar levels or higher blood pressure. So it's really important that patients take an active role in their own care by monitoring their blood pressures and their cholesterol, and their blood sugars on a regular basis. Another really important component of memory loss is undiagnosed or untreated depression and anxiety. The temporal lobe is really implicated in these diseases, and a lot of the medications like SSRIs that we use to treat these conditions also can help boost memory as well. For our smokers and heavy alcohol users, these are toxins that love the temporal lobes and this area that are affected by memory. The next thing is mental stimulation. A lot of times we'll see that patients, as they start to notice the changes in their memory, will start to withdraw from their environment. There's a lot of evidence that we learn more than we think from others, even in general conversation. Anywhere from new words to new thoughts, new ideas, and learning to encode new information on a regular basis is really important from socializing. And we see that more of the studies in children, but we do believe that the same process is happening even in our latter years. Another important thing to remember is how to break your routine. So if you've driven the same way from home to church every day, try a different route and see how that affects your memory, because it's constantly challenging the brain to perceive new information and to store it and retrieve it, okay? As Ms. Debbie did mention, that music and aromatherapy definitely stimulates the temporal lobes in particular. That's where we hear. The temporal lobes are associated with that, but it's a direct link to our memory centers. So we find in dementia patients even, they may not be able to remember a person's face that they've known for a long time, but they'll be able to recall a song. And that's also really helpful and calming to those patients in particular. So music therapy is really important as well. And then, of course, our cognitive exercises. I understand that you guys do a lot here at Dawson to kind of stimulate your mentation, and I think that's a great idea. I find that our elderly population kind of stays away from the internet and that kind of thing, but I definitely think that's part of breaking the routine and learning new things. So if you can do some of the websites that we have, you can do Lumosity. Lumosity is probably one of the most popular ones among patients, where you can do different like games that are associated with encoding memory and retrieving. You can also do things that don't include the internet, like taking the morning paper and discussing it with someone else to kind of challenge your knowledge of current events. That's a really popular one. Passages, reading passages to each other, and then trying to recall as much detail as possible about it is another one that our patients like to do. There's crossword puzzles and jigsaw puzzles that help with those visual spatial relationships. And we also encourage picking up a new hobby. Again, if you are a chess player, that won't be so so much to ask, but if you have never started a craft or started a gardening, all these things help to encourage new memories and challenge your brain to be able to encode that information. So in summary, basically dementia is not a normal part of aging. It does not have to happen. There are certain, I guess, relationships between your genes as well as your environment that can precipitate that, but a lot of times our patients perceive that it has to happen or this is a normal part of aging, and it's not. In fact, the occasional forgetfulness is definitely common, but it should not interrupt your daily function or your social interaction. We want to encourage diets that are rich in those antioxidants to stop the breakdown of the cell, as well as regular exercise, trying to get to that goal of 30 minutes five times a week. We want to get better sleep than we have been, and as well as managing those chronic illnesses. All of that is important. We kind of feed off of each other. It's a lot of evidence that the more socially interactive you are, the better your cognition is overall. And then you can use your everyday items like the newspaper or puzzle or even online resources to help keep the brain active.